I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seth Cohn.
I'm Heather Matthews.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Matthews.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Green from the Wallaroos.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we have a really great guest lined up for you today. We've got Faye Sheridan, who comes from a company called Healthy Her. And she's going to be talking about women's cycles and whether at elite sport, the coaching staff and the athletes themselves need to be paying more attention to that to be able to maximize their potential. I think that's going to be a really good chat.
Not talking bicycles, are we?
We're not talking bicycles, no. Anyway, I'm Ashley Morrison.
I'm John Lee.
Good to be back, John, and I must apologise to
you.
It has, and I'll tell you why, because I had a few interviews lined up, and then when I thought we were going to do them, the people that we were going to talk to suddenly were not available, and one of them we are going to be catching up with, hopefully for the next show. But they've just had things on their side of their life where they had to postpone it and we couldn't do it. So I apologise for that, but we will get those people on later on.
Look forward to it.
So who's going to start today?
You go first.
All right, I'm going to start. And it's a funny one, John, because, you know, I was a goalkeeper in my younger days. But I'm just beginning to ask a question here now. And I don't think... So we had the Euros, the women's Euros, and... The England Lionesses beat Spain, the world champions, in the final. Went to a penalty shootout, and it was during the penalty shootout. Now, this is interesting because the England goalkeeper, Hannah Hampson, is saying that she took the water bottle of the Spanish goalkeeper because she saw that she had written on it, like Maddie Hinch did in the hockey gold medal match at the Rio Olympics, where the where the English players were going to place their penalties. So she saw it and she claims she threw it into the crowd so that she had nothing to refer to later in the shootout. Now, let's be fair, Andrew Redmayne, the Socceroos goalkeeper, did exactly the same thing in the World Cup qualifier against Peru. So he saw that the Peruvian goalkeeper had that. He too threw the water bottle in the crowd. Now, if you throw a water bottle in football, you actually usually get a card for that. You're not meant to throw water bottles onto the pitch or off the pitch. But anyway, that's another thing. Now, my question with this now is, should the referee be going up to players before the shootout and looking at their water bottles and saying, you can't take that on if you've got that stuff written on it? Now, the reason I'm saying that is I remember having a conversation many years ago with Jamie Dwyer, probably one of the greatest hockey players to ever play for this country and probably in the world. And he said he used to have a little book that he kept on every player where he'd write down their weaknesses, things that they would do so he knew what was coming next, etc. Now, he never took that little book onto the field to play with him, and as the players running towards him whipped it out and went, oh, yeah, he's just done that, so he's going to go to the left-hand side. He memorized it. And again, if you look at cricket, fast bowlers usually do their prep before the game. They know who the top order batsmen are going to be, and they do their preparation, know he's weak on the leg stump, he falls away when he's playing this shot. And so you look to set them up. Yeah. They do not,
don't
again...
Don't bowl there, he'll hit it for six.
Yeah, exactly. And they don't actually go out with, you know, a water bottle with everything written on. So what I'm saying is, I think we need to cut this out. I think, yes, okay, players have done it, they've been allowed to do it. I don't think you should be allowed to take any notes or any written stuff onto the field of play with you. That should be it.
What about writing it on your arm?
Well, that's what Hannah Hampson said she did. And I don't actually see any problem with that because, I mean, let's be honest, we did it in exams.
So what's the difference between a water bottle and an arm?
Yeah, I mean, I think the arm, you can't, that's with you the whole game, isn't it? Let's be honest. So the water bottle, you know, it's something you're taking out and you're adding something to it. Look, I think, my view, I think, though, John, is really,
I think
a coach and the player should have done their preparation before the game, is what I'm saying. I don't think you should be taking stuff out. Like, I mean, you can't be taking notes onto the field of play.
No, and, across lots of different sports, lots of people write different things on their arms or hands or whatever. You see it quite often. It might be just a single word to remind them of a key word or something like that. Not sure you could get that much information on your arm about what people may, you know, taking flicks,
Well, I mean, you know, I wrote Ladies First about the 1988 women winning the gold medal for the Australian women winning the gold medal at the Olympic Games in hockey. And the goalkeeper there, she actually had written inside her pad where the player played.
On part of her equipment.
Yeah, on part of her equipment. But she didn't sort of go, hang on, I need my water bottle. Let's have a look at it. So, look, is that right? Is it wrong? I think there are other goalkeepers I've seen in international hockey as well who've done the same thing. They put tape on there and they've written on the tape where people go with the penalties on the inside of their pads.
Yeah, or could be just like the good old days where people remembered that sort of stuff.
And that's my argument. I think people should remember that.
I mean, in our grade we do. We remember guys that we play against. Oh, that fella there, we can't do this. Don't hit it to him because he'll trap it, that sort of stuff.
But you imagine now, you know, you got a boxer and he goes, oh, hang on a sec, I've got to pull out my notes. Oh, yeah, I mustn't move to the right.
Maybe on the back of your gloves.
Yeah, I mean, look, I just think it's something that we're seeing, and every time now that an opposing goalkeeper throws this water bottle away, it becomes a headline story and it gets...
Theater.
Yeah, and it gets rehashed for about a week, and I just think it shouldn't be allowed. I think you should just wipe it out. Let's get rid of it. Move on.
Going back to the point you made earlier about throwing the bottle away, maybe what would happen if umpires started saying, no, you can't take your water bottle stays over there.
Yeah. Well, that's one way to stop it, isn't it?
I don't know. Maybe they should be hydrated before they start the penalties and they won't need a water bottle.
Maybe. But it's funny because I saw another one recently, and it was in a little league game in America, because this is again blown up over there. Slightly different, but the bases were loaded, the batter's at the plate, and of course the catcher is giving the signal to the pitcher what he wants. Now, the kid that was on the sort of
second plate,
yeah, second base, yeah, he's got a clear view of what the catcher's doing, so he signals to the batter what's coming. Now, I would think he's perfectly entitled. If they're allowed to see, if the catcher's allowed a signal to the pitcher, why is the other batter not allowed a signal to his mate?
I would imagine throughout the entire history of baseball and softball, it has been possible to see the catcher's signals from second base. I'm just putting that out there.
I would agree. I was like, why is this suddenly such a big thing?
That only matters when the guy standing on second base knows what the signals mean.
Yeah.
You'd have to know what the signals mean. Maybe he's figured it out. He's seen that signal so many times, he's been able to link it to a particular ball.
Maybe, again, he's done his preparation.
Yes.
So, therefore, should he be penalised for having done his preparation and having worked out what the signals mean?
And what did they penalise him for? Looking at the guy who was making the signals or signalling to the batsman? Because if you're just standing there,
yeah, I think it was for signalling to the batsman, okay. And so it was deemed unsporting behaviour.
What?
Unsporting behaviour.
Oh, God. Isn't that what sport's all about?
Yeah,
do you know, like... would you do it? Everybody would do it.
But you know,
Barry, it's going to be this.
Yeah, I mean, in cricket, you used to know that bowlers like often would, you know, I mean, touch the ground like for a bit of dirt. It's going to be a slower ball. You know, that's just an example of something. The wicketkeeper knows, oh, yeah, slower ball's coming now. But the batsman, and often the batsman would work it out. And, I mean, who is the famous cricket? I think everyone, it's apocryphal, but I think it was like they said Jeff Boycott against one of them and no one could work out the spinner. And he walked down the wicket. He said, oh, I finally worked him out. And the other batsman goes, so what's he doing? He goes, well, you bloody work it out yourself. Now, I don't think Jeffrey did that. He may have done, but, you know, again, hey, look, I just think you do your prep before the game.
You're batting.
Yep.
And you sent a couple over square leg.
Cow shots, probably.
Yeah. And to short ball. So every time the bloke's bowled you a short ball, he's set up his field close catching. So you've hit him for a couple. And they move a guy out to square leg on the boundary. Where do you reckon the next ball's going? Just quietly. Maybe not the next one. But within the next two or three, you're probably going to get one that says, hit me over the square leg boundary. I mean, just...
Well, I remember actually doing this to a guy who actually became a really good friend of mine, and we played cricket together in the end, but playing against him. And I think he was playing for Somerset under-19s or under-21s. And he was left-handed, very strong on the leg side. And he'd kind of put me through the leg side, square leg, like hoiked it round there. Anyway, so I put a man deep there, and I put a deep, fine leg. And, you know, he thought I had more than two men behind square. But I didn't, because I told the square leg, stand behind square, but then move in front of square, because we also had a guy halfway. So he thought, oh, this is going to be short. And I bought him a Yorker. And he went on the back foot, and he literally had his bat ready to hook it. And I Yorked him, and he was so angry. He stood there going, this is not fair. And I've wound him up about it for a long, long time.
There's, you know, part of the joy of playing sport is that
outthinking the other person.
And there's been so many occasions over the years where people have just been a little bit smarter than the opposition. And nowadays, you know, this whole fair, the whole concept of fair.
Yeah.
And oh, it's got to be fair for everybody. No, it doesn't. No.
As long as it's within the rules.
And sometimes people are better at working the rules to their favour than other people are. Now, how can you stop someone from using their eyes and telling their teammate something's going to happen now and I'm telling you this to better our team's performance? I'm not sure. I haven't done anything in anywhere near the world of cheating. I'm standing here. They're making signals. I'm looking there because that's where I'm supposed to be looking. I've got to watch.
But you've seen it in football again, where there's a penalty, say, in a game, and there's an international player who plays with a club player, so he knows where this guy places his penalty. And he'll be standing on the edge of the box saying to his goalkeeper, it's going to your right, you know? And the goalkeeper goes to the right and saves it. And so are you saying that that's not allowed? I'm saying that's fine, but I just don't think you should have it written on a water bottle.
I think goalkeepers should stand with their back to the striker until the striker starts his run on the ball, and then he's allowed to turn around just so that you can't pick up any signals.
Well, you do that at training. But then the question is, do you turn to your right, to your left?
And just before we move on, taking you back to the original point, which started with the women's...
European Championships.
Championships with the famous shootout.
Yep.
Joey Barton.
Do we really want to go on to Joey Barton on this podcast?
I was just wondering how many penalties he took.
Yeah, I wouldn't know that.
Yeah.
But he's now withdrawn from X or Twitter as it was.
Has he? Oh, he
because he's realised he's getting himself in too much trouble, and he said the legal fees are getting too expensive.
Well, it was a pretty dumb thing to come out with. You can.
Hey, he's come out with a lot of dumb stuff.
You can potentially make criticisms of women's football versus men's football on a whole host of areas. If you really want to, if that's your thing, go ahead. But missing penalties? I don't think so.
Yeah. Less said about that, the better, I think.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe, and you're listening to Not The Footy Show.
Well, as I said at the top of the show, our guest on this show is a lady called Faye Sheridan. Now, Faye is going to talk to us about a subject that most men will know, I think, very little about. And I profess that I knew very little about it. But it is, of course, a woman's cycle and how it affects them in elite sport. Should there be more information out there? And certainly should the players be looking to get more information so that it doesn't affect their performance as much as it possibly can? Faye Sheridan, welcome to Not The Footy Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
No, really looking forward to catching up with you, as I saw a little video clip of yours that piqued my interest and thought, we've got to get her on Not The Footy Show.
Yeah.
Maybe you can just tell us a little bit of your background, because I know you've obviously the founder of Healthy Her, But you've got a background in both physical training, nutrition as well, haven't you?
Yeah. So I've been in the, I guess I'll say, health and fitness industry for about 10 years. And I have always played, you know, sport from a young age as well. So I have played, you know, state league netball. And I was also a swimmer when I was younger as well. So I've always been heavily involved in sport, whether it's a team sport or an individual sport, and then kind of carried that through into things like powerlifting and stuff like that. And so I own a gym with my partner, and he still very much trains people in person, whereas I've gravitated more towards, I guess, more of like the health component when it comes to women, and more specifically getting women to understand their hormones on a deeper level and this cycle that women have from, you know, those early teenage years all the way through to, you know, perimenopause.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of the things that I found so interesting, because we've obviously seen a surge in women's sport in the last 20 years. We're seeing so many of these women's sports now becoming professional, where women can actually earn a living from them, which is great. But then there's still a very male-dominated sort of coaching aspect. And even a lot of the strength and conditioning coaches tend to be men. I mean, I know there are some women, but you don't see that many. And that was where you were saying, maybe with these specific requirements that are very much a female requirement, we need to see more women.
Yeah, definitely. And I think for so many years, women have been trained like small men, when our hormones are completely different. You know, our needs, nutritional needs are completely different. The way that we train, the way that we recover, all of these things are totally different to men. And so I'm seeing it a lot now, where it is definitely being taken into consideration, but I still do feel like we've got a long way to go as well.
Muscle development as well, that's another area that I've been told is different between men and women, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when it comes to women, we've got these ebbs and flows of these hormones. So at certain parts of our cycle, it might be harder for us to recover, or we might not be able to exert ourselves as much. And so that could potentially impact, you know, muscle development. It could also impact injuries and things like that. Like we can be more susceptible to injuries in and around certain parts of our cycle as well.
Well, that's a known fact, isn't it? Because, I mean, women are already more prone to getting ACL injuries than men. But then when they are having their cycle, they are even more at risk. But the problem you have is, obviously, in a team environment, women tend to sink, don't they? And then so you can't take the team away and say, well, we won't play you, because you'd have to take the whole team out.
Definitely. And I think as well, there was this big, like, once this was being spoken about, there was this big fear ingrained to women, like, you're going to be more susceptible to, you know, say an ACL injury in and around ovulation, or you're going to be more susceptible to injuries as you, you know, nearer to your bleed or something like that. And so what we just need is we need more awareness, and then control the things that are in our control. Because if we are a woman and we are cycling, we have no control over that whatsoever. We can't decide to, well, I wouldn't want people to decide to skip their period, or, you know, I mean, a lot of women are still on birth control, and then birth control can alter this whole process anyway. So, it's just bringing that awareness and then controlling what we can control, like nutrition, like recovery, sleep, all of those things. And then just taking into consideration at certain times of a woman's cycle, they are going to be more susceptible to injury.
When I told someone that I was going to be talking to you, they said to me about that nutrition side of things. They said, well, what should you eat, and how do you know what is right for you?
Yeah. Again, it's like we've got men and women, but then we've also got women, and there's so many different types of women. You know, some women might have faster metabolism. Some women might have more muscle mass than others. So it's very hard to say what nutrition and the quantity, more specifically, of what someone's needs are, because women differ in that. Some women might need more food. Some women might need less food. And so what it comes down to, and what you can focus on from this, chat, is more about the quality of nutrition and really focusing on, one, getting enough protein, because a lot of women lack in that department when, you know, getting protein. And that's really important for, one, building muscle recovery and also supporting menstruation as well and ovulation. And then, so yeah, making sure you're getting enough protein from animal sources, enough, you know, fiber, fruits, vegetables, and getting enough carbohydrates and healthy fats as well, because all of these, and more specifically aiming for predominantly whole foods. It's okay to have a few, you know, processed foods here and there. And sometimes, you know, if you're playing a sport, a lot of people will kind of, you know, give you some sort of quick carbohydrates like lollies or Gatorade or something like that. And that's totally fine. But it's more importantly, you want to look at the bigger picture of, like, what is your nutrition consisting of? Are you getting enough protein? Are you getting enough carbohydrates to support your output and your recovery, and also healthy fats to support your hormones as well?
So listening to that then as well, it's much more of an individualist approach, really, isn't it? Because everybody's very different. So in that team, female team environment, you need to have somebody that can actually adapt to each individual to get the maximum out of them. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's always going to be a skeleton kind of, you know, aim for this. But yeah, there is definitely this kind of individualized approach when it comes to nutrition, because I could have someone who is super lean, might need a little bit more body fat because they are, their output is maybe negatively impacting their cycle. And so they might require more food. There might be someone else on the team that is predominantly higher body fat, and maybe they're having issues with, say, something like PCOS, which is an ovarian disorder, and they may need to alter their carbohydrate intake or play around with timing of carbohydrates. So it does become a little bit more complex for women, because we are dealing with a lot of these ovarian disorders, and then we've got menstrual cycle, you know, the menstrual cycle that we need to take into consideration as well, and as well as performance and training and recovery.
Now, you know, in sport as well, that the sort of mind can play a big part. So can emotions. So again, if you're doubting yourself, you're in a bad run of form, again, can this be affected within the female sort of psyche as well? Because I've been around women as well, and their emotions can change during their cycle.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if we look at something like, you know, the late luteal phase, which is where a woman is entering in towards her bleed, we're going to see drops in estrogen and progesterone, and these things can alter mood as well as like physiological responses in the body, but it can also alter mood. And so a big thing that comes up for women in this part of their cycle is their inner critic can become a lot louder. So a lot of self-doubt can creep in and around this time of the cycle. And then you've got the physical changes, like, you know, muscle contraction decreases drastically in this late part of the cycle. So their response time to maybe changing direction or muscle firing is a lot slower. And so that might, you know, impact their performance. And then you've got this vicious cycle of, well, maybe they're not performing very well that week. And then you've got this inner critic, and then you've got these hormones that are coming into play as well. So if you don't have that level of awareness about your cycle and about how these hormones can impact you from a psychological and physiological component, then it can can play havoc on your mindset and your psyche with games and or whatever performance sport you play.
How aware do you think women actually are at the sort of elite level in sport? Because in my brief, or I mean, I've been involved in sport for a long time, but I don't think that many women are as aware as you're making me now.
Yeah. I don't think women are very aware. I don't know if it's changed much. I haven't been involved in many kind of elite team sports. I think it's becoming more popular in the elite, like in the very top tier, teams like netball or football. But in the like the lower or the up and coming teams, it's definitely not spoken about enough. And I've got this kind of hierarchy of like it's a level one to a level four, and usually women are sitting around a level two when it comes to their reproductive system and their hormones. And that level two is they just know when their next period's coming. And so that's not really enough information. We're missing so many other so many other key elements to the menstrual cycle. So really, I'd love to see women at this kind of level four where they know when they're ovulating, they know when their bleed is coming, they know that they're in the follicular phase, they know they're in the late luteal phase, all of these things. So yeah, I do have this kind of like score that I use with my clients. It's like a level one to a level four, and I would love most women to sit at level four.
I mean, the other thing I'm thinking listening to you is there also needs to be an educational process for the male coaches to start to understand some of this. Because if we're not going to see women's coaches coming through, then the men need to be educated. I mean, have you had any sort of male coaches saying, look, can you explain this to me or give me a better understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I've been fortunate enough to work with coaches. So I do a lot of mentoring with coaches. I've worked for education platforms before where I've educated other coaches, especially male coaches, on this. And I love it. And they, once they start to understand, you can see them implement this into their coaching. But I do feel like for men, obviously they're not living and breathing it. So they will need to understand it, on a deeper level, but it's not to say that you can't learn it and you can't start to implement things with your team or with your clients or what have you, if you're a coach. But it's very powerful. Once you understand it, it's like, okay, we can alter things. We can change things. We can educate the athlete to understand their cycle on a deeper level and how it can impact, like I said before, physically and emotionally as well.
Is the biggest challenge getting people to sort of almost move away from this one-size-fits-all approach for all athletes? Is that the hardest thing to break that barrier down?
Yeah, I think that's the biggest hurdle that we're running into is like it might be, you know, finances or it might be, you know, having that individualized approach to each person on the team. That's where it's going to become a lot harder. And like I said, you can have that kind of skeleton, that blanket kind of skeleton, but there's going to be people that don't fit into the mold. There's going to be people that don't fit into like this skeleton kind of outlook of nutrition and training and all of that kind of stuff. And, you know, we're seeing rises of issues with ovarian disorders in women. So I'm talking like PCOS, endometriosis, you know, hypothalamic amenorrhea is another one that we see with athletes, and that's complete loss of menstrual cycle due to not eating enough food and training output being too high. So there's a lot of things that we will run into when working with women. And then another thing that we need to look at is gut health as well. And so they all tie into one another. And I think the biggest hurdle is that we just don't have, more often than not, these teams don't have the finances to maybe put into something like nutrition and recovery for women.
Yeah, I mean, when I was sort of reading up before this conversation today, I read one thing that you said where women need to be aware of changes in their cycle and investigate that, especially if they're an athlete. I mean, they would need to do it probably in normal life, I would think, as well. But as an athlete, yeah, it is something that they shouldn't ignore, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And there's so much information out there now that I feel like the athlete needs to take a little bit of responsibility for themselves as well. We can't always count on the coach or the nutritionist. So that's why, no, if you're an athlete or just general population, a woman needs to understand her body on a deeper level so that she can not just constantly give her power over to a coach or a nutritionist or something like that. Because once you have that level of awareness of your hormones and your menstrual cycle, there's no turning back and you'll feel very empowered in the decisions that you need to make with so many things in life. So,
I mean, yeah,
it's a life skill. Yeah. No, I was just going to say it's a life skill, understanding your hormones and the rhythms that women go through.
I mean, when we were talking before, there was, I mentioned to you about it, I think it was in 2022, Lydia Ko, the New Zealand golfer. Yep. She had a physio come out on the course to massage her back and gave a famous interview that it was, I think, probably the first time that an elite female athlete had talked about her cycle, because she said, oh, look, it's that time of the month. You know what I'm talking about, women. And she said, my back gets really tight and twisted and I needed to get it released. Now, how much good does that do to sort of the cause that you're getting, to make women be more aware but also able to talk about it?
Yeah, I think the more women at a higher level talk about it and the more that were exposed to these women talking about it, it's not so taboo. It's not so shamed upon or anything like that. And so having these, you know, high athletes or these, you know, high performing athletes, it's great for women to talk out about it. And I feel like they should be talking out about it more and, you know, getting that on kind of stuff on media as well. Like I remember doing a powerlifting competition, and I had to pull a 1RM on my deadlift on the first day of my bleed. And it was horrific, but got through it. And it's not to say that you can't get through it and you can't perform on that day. And I did pull a PB, but my God, it felt so different from if I was trying to pull that PB, say, you know, in that early follicular phase or, you know, after my period or around ovulation. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I've told people that we're talking and some people are going, oh, why are you talking about that on the show? But to me, it is a topic that needs to be spoken about, especially as women's sport progresses. And if it wants to be taken seriously, we have to understand this.
Yeah. And also the way that your performance can be like day and night, depending on where you're at in your cycle. So if a player is not performing well, the first thing I would be asking is like, where are you at in your cycle? Like, what's your nutrition been like? What's your sleep been like? Because all of these things, if there's hormonal imbalances, this can also impact things like sleep. It can also impact gut health and things like that as well. So, yeah, if a athlete is underperforming for some reason, we need to be looking at their menstrual cycle as well. Maybe they're under recovering. Maybe they're constantly getting injured. And so all of these are red flags as red flags that we should be looking into as a coach of like, okay, what's going on internally that is impacting their performance, their recovery, and so on.
Finally, I mean, I could talk for a lot longer, but we've only got so much time. But finally, I mean, you touched on it before about injuries. And I mean, the little I've read about sort of women when they are menstruating, how they are at higher risk of an ACL injury, they're at a higher risk of concussion, and they take longer to recover from concussion. I mean, how are we going to get over these, or are they just things that women are going to have to kind of learn to live with or to try and manage?
Yeah, so, I mean, women are more susceptible to like something like an ACL injury, more so around ovulation, because there's a surge of estrogen in and around ovulation, which creates this laxity in the ligaments. And then as far as we've also got women who have like a wider pelvis in comparison to men. So their Q angle, their hips to their knee ratio, the angle makes them more susceptible to ACL as well. So it's more about just understanding and being informed. And then, like I said before, controlling what is in our control. So we can't control where we're at in our cycle, but what we can do is we can train a certain way with, you know, an emphasis on technique and controlled movements and recovery. We can also make sure that we're fueling our body so we're less susceptible to injury, making sure that we are recovering well, so getting enough sleep, all of that kind of stuff. I know when I did my ACL, when I played netball, I definitely wasn't eating properly and I definitely wasn't recovering well either. So there could be a few contributing factors as to why I had an ACL, but I do remember that it was in and around ovulation as well for me.
Well, there you go. So you're the voice of experience as well. So you're kind of I've really strong position.
Full-blown ACL, yeah, when I played netball, so...
Well, look, Faye, thank you so much for your time. It is fascinating, even to a man like me, just to learn about it, because I do think it's very interesting how, you know, athletes prepare to be their best. And obviously this has a big impact on it. So thanks so much for your time today. And hopefully people have found it educational.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
I'm Caitlin Bassett and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
And And that was Faye Sheridan from the company Healthy Her. And she also has a podcast of her own called She Breaks the Rules. So if you want to have a listen to that, it's a good listen. I have to say, in preparation for that interview, I didn't listen to a couple of episodes. But I think it's a really interesting thing, John. I mean, if women's sport is coming up, which it has, and this is our 20th year of Not the Footy Show. And if you look, when we launched it, it was all about trying to give sports that didn't get the coverage, and also to try and raise the profile of women's sport. Now, a lot of people, I think, have forgotten that we were doing that 20 years ago. But anyway, if you look at where women's sport has come in that 20 years now, and the profile that it has, and the amount that they're trying to get higher and higher and be more professional, I think what Faye is talking about is actually a point that many people have forgotten.
Yeah, I must admit, I'm a bit perplexed that this sort of stuff is still not as, because it's not something you generally talk about, is it? You know, look, certainly not amongst males, I'm sure the girls do. But, I mean, we still have the Australian Institute of Sport. And they had all sorts of scientists and blah, 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 and people like that.
Nutritionists as well. We've had nutritionists on the show.
Isn't this a subject that would have been under some sort of comprehensive study for a long time now?
You would have thought so, wouldn't you?
I just assumed, before hearing this interview, I just assumed that that sort of stuff was already factored in, that they were already on top of all of that.
Yeah, look, some sports maybe. Yeah. But I think the majority are not, would
are we
be my
as well
understanding.
About community level sport. So amateurs like me, well, not me, but like me. Do you know what
yeah.
I mean?
The female equivalent of you.
Yeah. It is, well, that's just, anyway, is it more aimed at them? Are the elite level already at that point? But it sounded to me from this that the elite level's not at that point. It's something that's, maybe because it feels a bit strange to talk about publicly, because it's not something that gets talked about in a huge way publicly.
Look, as I say, I think some sports are looking at it. As Faye said in the interview, some of it is the cost, because there is no one size fits all. So therefore, they have to sit down with each individual athlete, go through their symptoms, go through what nutrition is best for them. So there is a lot of time to be invested. There is then obviously making out sure what it works. I would say that certainly in sports where you still have a male coach or a male strength and conditioning coach, I would say there's very little done about it. That's my assumption. Certainly that is the case.
Yeah, we should make the point that as far as this conversation is concerned, just about everything we say is an assumption.
Yeah, I mean, you made a comment there. People don't want to talk about it. And as I said in the interview, I don't know if you saw that interview in 2022, Lydia Ko, the golfer. Now, she had a physio on the course, and it was quite funny because the interviewer goes, oh, you know, you had your physio out massaging your back, you know, is this going to be a problem? And she goes, no, time of the month, and you ladies know what I'm talking about. She said, but my back gets really stiff, and it was tightening up, and so I got the physio out there. Now, this was 2022, and it got a lot of publicity because it was possibly the first time an elite female athlete in a sport had talked about periods in an interview. And I thought it was fantastic but the poor guy doing the interview, he should have gone, he didn't know what to say.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And that's why, a part of why I wanted to talk about it today, because I saw Faye give an interview and she was saying that we need to educate coaches to understand what women go through, if they're necessarily male coaches, and also how it's different for every woman and what can be done to lessen the impact on their performance.
Are we potentially talking about maybe some players just not playing at a given point in time because it could be deemed to be unhealthy for them?
I don't know enough about that, but I mean, that's a good rhetorical question. I would think there may be some players where, I mean, you know, I've had girlfriends where their period pain was intense, you know, like they were having to take days off work. So if it was as bad as that, I would think that yes, there would be some players that would have to withdraw.
And also potentially people who, because they have suffered those sorts of symptoms, don't get involved because they think, well, I'm only going to, you know, I can't play.
Yeah.
Because this happens to me every month or whatever.
But anyway, hopefully you listeners out there enjoyed that and found it informative, and certainly it's raised questions for us to think a little bit broader than we probably did before. Hopefully it
Absolutely.
Has with you.
And it's something that should, they should spend the money on it. I mean, do you reckon they'd spend the money on it if men had periods?
Oh, I would think so, yeah.
Yeah.
There'd be a whole special department.
I mean,
but then probably male sport would stop for that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, we just...
Because we can't handle the pain.
Probably not. Now, look, I must admit, that's something that we should be talking about a whole lot more. And look, and get over the sort of male attitudes towards menstruation and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
Really, that
if we are moving forward, that should happen.
Yeah. For men, it shouldn't be a big deal at all. We should be able to have those conversations.
That's why I did.
Yeah. Thank you very much, sir. Hey, staying with women's sport, did you see the NBA girls in the All-Star game? And the T-shirts, the training shirts they wore, the warm-up shirts.
I did see a photograph of it, mm-hmm. and I read a small piece of the article. I got to be honest, I didn't read it all, but I did see it, yes.
And it was pay us what we you
yep,
owe us.
Yeah, I did see that, or, yep.
Yeah. Because it's a really tough subject to sink your teeth into and to come up with any sort of stance on, because there's so much... what was the word I used before?
Ingenuineness
about the arguments being made. And we talked before about when did top tier level one football start in England?
Well, yeah, I mean the first division, okay, as it used to be called, yeah. was back in the 1880s.
I mean, the first division is essentially what's Premier League now.
Yeah, so that was back in the 1880s. The Premier League itself started in 1992.
Okay, forget the fact that these competitions have changed their names, because that's irrelevant to the narrative. So the first guys in that first few years, how much would they have been getting paid?
Well, they were all amateurs back then, so it's probably a little bit different. The money that they were getting... I mean, of course, currency's changed, hasn't it? But they were getting sort of like £2 or £4 a year. But if you look at the first £100 player was in the 1950s. And then you had, you know, this
a
was...
week, £100 a week.
I think that was... They broke the salary cap was around the 60s was when suddenly there was... They could pay players what they wanted, you know, what it was up to individual clubs.
Yeah. So that's a fairly long... The growth to now where players are getting millions and, you know...
Well, ridiculous amounts per week,
has been, what, 140-year process?
Yeah. I mean, I would say definitely if you're going from,
And there's
at least 50, 60 years.
You're talking about there was no television back when they started, and television was hardly around in the 50s.
Yeah.
So a lot of money comes from television rights now. But... crowds were still exceptional back then. Owners were still making money, you know. They were doing all right for themselves out of a football club if you were a reasonable sized club. So they were probably the point I'm making is that you can't expect to start a league and start at the top.
Yeah, you have to work your way up.
You've got to work your way up. Now, some people might say, oh, yes, but there's been women's basketball for... Blah, blah, blah.
Look, the only way you can get around that, John, is if you have somebody that's going to underwrite it for X amount of years, because it takes time to establish it. It takes time to establish the teams, the rivalries. I hate when rivalries are manufactured. Rivalries evolve. You cannot manufacture just because a team lives down the road. That may not be your biggest rival. It may be someone because of an incident in one game, and that rivalry will last forever. So, you know, those things take time to happen. But unless you've got somebody that's bankrolling it, then, you've got to build it slowly.
I would love to see the best women sports people in any given sport being paid what their male equivalents are. But we're in an entertainment industry. Highest paid players don't get paid because they're the best. That they get paid that money because they bring eyeballs and bums on seats.
Well,
that's what, look at what happens now when, they had the famous basketball trade where, I can't remember the guy's name. The Croatian guy went from one club to another club and blah, blah. And they were talking about the drop off on social media accounts. People follow players now.
Yeah, they do. The youth follow the player rather than the team.
And so that dynamic's changed a lot about who and why and when people consume their sport.
Well, the prime example is, I forget the Japanese player that Arsenal signed years ago. And his transfer fee was paid off from the merchandise of, so shirts sold with his name in Japan within a month. Now, if you looked at David Beckham when he went to Real Madrid, and this is a famous story, where he gave his first interview in Spain on TV, and the Real Madrid merchandising people said, can you wear a Real Madrid tracksuit top? Because they had them in their sort of apparel for fans to buy, and it was not selling. And it was a real, you know, and so he wore it on TV. They sold out in 2 days. They got rid of all the stock that they hadn't been able to move. And there was a Mexican, I think, that signed for Paris Saint-Germain, who actually outstripped the return that Real Madrid got on Beckham within a week. So again, yeah, exactly what you're saying. Some of these players can attract that much money. They may not even play that much, but their persona and their brand is so big, it will generate money for you.
And I mean, some of the arguments too that, I mean, you know, this team is valued at. Valued at, it doesn't mean that money's sitting in a bank for those people to just go and spend willy-nilly.
But also value is only what someone's prepared to pay. You can think it's worth that, but if no one's prepared to pay it, it's not worth it.
That's in real estate all the time, doesn't it? Sometimes you're more, sometimes you get less. And remember, the valuations of these companies aren't necessarily cold hard cash valuations. It's, do you own your own stadium? What's the contract you have, and how much is that contract worth with the stadium holder that you play? What's the contract with this person worth? What's that worth? It's not necessarily about how much money you are generating.
Yep.
And there's a lot of stuff going on in that argument that I think both sides are trying to make their point, but they're being very disingenuous about the points they're making.
But if you look at the A-League in Australia, now, you would have seen in the news recently that Western United have had their license taken away. Now, it was only a year ago Perth Glory had their license taken away. You've got the Central Coast Mariners in trouble. You've got Brisbane Roar in trouble. Now, you know, again, the payers are not getting paid on time. Superannuation's not being paid. That's what the Western United issue was all about. Now, I've spoken to people in these clubs. I've tried to speak to people within the PFA, which is the Professional Footballers Association, because my belief is that the PFA have caused the problems for the A-League, in that what they've been doing is, yes, their job is to try and get the best deal for all the players, and they're there to represent the players when they don't get paid and things like that. There definitely is a place for the PFA. But what they've done is pushed the salaries of the players too high for the club owners to be able to cover them. And what this comes down to again is exactly what you were saying, John. You have to, if you want that money, then the season has to be longer. The A-League cannot be a six-month league. It needs to be 9 months, and the players have got to play more games to get more people through the gate to generate that revenue that they may be able to then be able to pay the players what the players are asking for at the moment. If they're only going to play the amount of games they're playing at the moment, and for half the teams the season's over halfway through the competition, then you're really going to struggle. You're always going to struggle, and the clubs are not going to be able to cover their costs. And I blame the PFA for pushing the salaries up too much, because also what you're seeing now And I saw there's a player who has been over in Europe. He's coming back to play in the A-League at 22. You should be just about to be hitting your prime in your career. So why would you want to come back and play in Australia? Because it's easy money. There's not the pressure. He knows he'll get a game. Whereas playing for a big club in Europe, you've got to fight for that place. And this is where the players of yesteryear, your likes of Stan Lazaridis, your likes of Paul Ocon, you know, Craig Moore, Kevin Muscat, who hung in
Lucas
there.
Neal.
Yeah, Lucas Neal. They all fought for their places and they battled it out. Yeah, they didn't get picked every week to start with, but they learnt the game at a lower club and then they established themselves and then they earned it. But they should be shown a lot more respect. Even, you know, let's go a bit further back. Dave Mitchell, my friend, you know, was the former Perth Glory coach, one of the first Australian players to go. Well, he was the first Australian to play in the Scottish Premier League, first Australian to play in the Eredivisie in the Netherlands, first Australian to play in the Bundesliga. And I remember Ned Zelic saying to me, if it hadn't been for Dave Mitchell, he goes, I would never have got a contract in Germany. So these guys really set the bar, but it disappoints me to see players coming back at 22, 23. But it's because it's now they can make a living here, whereas before they had to really strive to do that. But we're paying too much money for a league that doesn't play enough games.
I think something else we've got to realise, especially at the top end of professional sport, and I'm talking globally, is forget about the money that sports get from broadcast deals for a second. Just forget about it. But if you took private equity money out of sport, it would collapse.
Yep.
It would collapse today. These private equity companies and private owners lose millions. How much do you reckon it costs a Premier League owner? How much do they lose a year?
Yeah, it's...
And we know they lose because they've had to put bloody rules in place to stop people losing money.
The financial fair play,
exactly.
But yeah.
And yet they still do. Which owners in Australia make a profit out of the A-League?
Well, there's none. None of them do.
Yeah.
There's not a single club that's making a profit.
And that's...
And it's been going now since 2003, so...
And that's
22
not a
years.
Sport, 22, sport,
yeah,
thing.
22
that's
years.
Sport.
Yeah.
So, we've been talking about it's a busted system that's been kept afloat by rich men, generally, who've got money to burn. And look at an NFL owner. They burn money.
But also, John, as we said, I think this won't come as a surprise to anyone who listens to this regularly. I think a lot of these sports are poorly administered. And that's why, again, they are going hand in hand to the governments all the time saying, bail us out, bail us out. And the government needs to turn around and say, nah, we're not bailing you out anymore.
Well, they shouldn't have to.
I agree.
Yeah. It's just... when we turned sport into a product, and it is a business now, and it's a business that fails, no other business could operate like sport operates. Shareholders would, you know...
Who it was said to me once. They said, the thing that they could not understand is businessmen, successful businessmen, who are ruthless in their business world, they then get involved in sport and common sense goes out the window.
Yeah.
And they said it is quite scary how these people just lose all perspective.
It all becomes ego.
Yeah.
And you know what? At the end of the day, they're burning our money. They got rich taking our money and now they're burning it.
Oh, I could say that about the government with Optus Stadium, couldn't we? That's a subject for another day.
Ooh, okay.
See ya. We'll be back next week.